Lawrence Krauss is president of the Origins Project Foundation, professor in the School of Earth and Space.
I'm retired.
Oh, you're retired. Okay, we'll just go with this. Okay. He's retired, but he's still...
How about you just do this?
How about you tell me?
Let's just be simple. Okay. That's probably better. I'm president of the Origins Project Foundation, a nonprofit tax-exempt foundation, trying to spread the word about science and rationality and get people excited about the real world, and also host of the Origins podcast with Lawrence Krauss, as well as writing my book. So I've retired from my academic positions.
Great. Okay. But you haven't forgotten all of the stuff that you knew before, right?
I hope not.
Very good. Welcome to the Bibliophile.
It's nice to be with you virtually.
I wish it was real, just like science is.
Yeah, exactly. The reality is that which continues to exist even when you stop believing in it. That's the definition.
That's Philip K. Dick.
Okay. You got it. You remember that. Very few people know that. That's one of my favorite lines of Philip K. Dick.
Yeah. Well, what I want to talk to you about is why you write about science and how you write about science. And it seems to me there's two types of writing about science. First, there's for your fellow academics so that you can get citations, so that you can get funding, and of course, enable the progress of science. But the second is to write for a general public, and I assume that you hope to get funding through that as well, correct?
Well, yeah, in a way, funding has never really been the key factor behind any of my writing. I write my scientific articles because I want to do science and I want to make progress. And my popular writing is meant because I think it's important to reach the public. Of course, the popular writing it brings in money from the sale of books. But in terms of funding my research, because I'm a theoretical physicist, I don't have a lot of equipment. So I've had students and postdocs that I need to fund, and that's been through my grants. But the reason for writing is always to communicate. And actually, the reason for writing is the same reason I do science, because I enjoy it. And it's what I want to do. I think most people don't realize that while one wants to do science, maybe to push the frontiers forward, as I certainly do, the reason people become scientists is because they enjoy doing it. Otherwise, you wouldn't spend so much time on it. And the reason I spend hours, years sometimes writing books, even though I enjoy it, it can be exhausting, is ultimately I must enjoy it. Because you can never spend that much time on something if you didn't enjoy it.
Well, you've got the luxury to do what you enjoy.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I've got the luxury to do what I enjoy. Exactly. As a scientist, I have the luxury of asking questions and people paying me to think about things. And as a writer who, you know, has been reasonably successful, I'm fortunate enough to be able to write and have people pay me for that too, which is just a lovely thing. And now that I've retired from my academic positions, writing is perhaps the greatest luxury because I can do it when I want. And my last book, which, for example, the book that's coming out in January, my first book I've ever written without sort of having a contract in advance. It was during the pandemic. I had nothing else to do, and I said, I'm going to write this book. And I was driven to write it, and I wrote in 12 weeks what would have taken me 12 months if I had my day job, which is what I normally have had in my past writing. But I have that luxury, and I recognize it as a luxury and a privilege, and I don't ever take it for granted.
There are, though, for scientists, correct me if I'm wrong, but they need to write a certain number of, like you've written 300 or more than 300 research articles, and you write those, of course, to forward science, but you also want to get citations from other scientists so that... like it helps your organization to get more money.
I mean, there's publish or perish, I suppose. And one recognizes that if one isn't an active researcher, one won't be supported for one's research. So that's in the back of your mind. But I think what's really, if you're doing the research to get the funding.
Yeah. Then, I mean, no, that's the cart before the horse.
So I think for someone like me, I mean, I think I was I've written many papers, and I think it's because I was driven by whatever drives me. But recognizing that, of course, that one thing feeds another, that by being successful, it allowed me the opportunity to do more. So there's, of course, that feedback. But you recognize, certainly I recognize as an academic that I have a responsibility to be active. But that's never driven me as much as the desire to actually do the work itself.
Yeah.
I hope it always was that way. And moreover, ultimately, I always recognize that the funding allowed me to have students and postdocs and keep a group going, which I eventually, and I kept a group going for many, many years. And so I felt a responsibility to those other people to ensure that we were at an active program. But for me, I didn't need any additional funding to do what I wanted to, because it's just a computer which I already had and a pencil and paper. And so I'm fortunate that way. But I realized I had a responsibility to keep an active group going. That involved hiring people who were themselves active and having good students. Once you become sort of more senior, you're working with good students and good postdocs who are helping keep you going. They're helping drive you. You do an input of time to help people get started, and then my students would teach me as much as I would teach them. Ultimately, once they were well on their PhD with their PhD.
Well, it's true that in order to learn something, the best way to learn something is to teach it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And to write about it, would you say?
Oh, writing, absolutely. It's writing about it brings a whole different level of understanding. There are many things that I thought I understood fully, which until I started to write about it, I realized I didn't. Because somehow when you put it down on paper, or if you can see it, know it's going to be printed, you feel an extra responsibility to have everything exactly right, because it's there in perpetuity. You, if you're lecturing in a classroom, I suppose if you make a mistake, it's just, and that's unfortunate. But somehow when you've got it written down, it's there with your name on it. So one of the useful things about my popular writing is it's caused me to rethink certain scientific concepts that I thought I understood. So there's a feedback. Some people say, why do you write your popular books? It takes time away from your research. And to some extent it does. But first of all, it keeps me going and I enjoy it. But secondly, there have been many times where it's enhanced my scientific understanding.
Hmm. Well, with the journal writing, the academic writing, there's the peer review process, right?
Yeah, which is often frustrating, but it's part of the game. You have to. I used to say peer review involved sending papers to idiots who don't understand anything, and having to convince them that you're right. But it's a useful process, and I think ultimately it's a very important process. I think for improving work in the long run. Yeah, it's an imperfect process, and nowadays, frankly, with the internet. Most physics articles, all my articles and all most people's articles are submitted to an online archive well before they appear in a journal. And nowadays, I've had articles which are now heavily cited, which I never bothered to submit to the journal. I mean, to completely end up submitting to the journal, because I put it online and then I submitted the journal and I got a series of ridiculous referees reports, and it just wasn't worth the time. Everyone could read it and it was getting cited anyway. So, there are a few, one or two highly cited articles of mine that are only available on the archive.
Hmm. What about the difference between, to say, a normal history book and a book that you've written about physics, like The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far? There must be an extra layer of review that needs to take place.
Well, it depends, again, on your publishing arrangement. Sometimes some books, if it's a textbook, or some publishers will insist they send things out to reviewers before they print it. But generally, once you have, an arrangement, if you're a historian writing a book for Simon & Schuster, generally the only review that takes place is with your editor. And I think they assume you have the academic credentials to back things up. But I think what the difference is perhaps the level of scholarship. I actually, as it turns out, I used to do history. And so I'm quite aware of the kind of scholarship that's required to write history. I enjoy, in a number of my books, I have done what I, kind of historical work of checking sometimes primary sources and working through things. But the level of documentation of the history one of the reasons I don't have a lot of footnotes in my popular books is I don't want to give the illusion that they are that they're that level of a scholarly textbook.
Okay.
You know, for key things, I try and indicate where the sources are. Now, for the new book that I've written on climate change, there are a lot of more references, if you wish, because I think it's important for people to be able to look at that data themselves. It's such an important topic. But in general, I think the level of backup referencing is different for an academic historical work than a popular work.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
A work that claims to be history. You know, there's some professional historians who write history books primarily and, you know, publish popular bestsellers. And they and their books have lots of footnotes and references, too, because they're writing as professional historians. In any case, I am going to be writing a history book in one of my next few books, and that will be done with the kind of level of scholarship that I would expect of a history book.
Well, in fact, the greatest story ever told so far gives all sorts of short bios of various great scientists, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think the history is a really important, a useful way to communicate, help people follow the story.
Yeah.
The history is fascinating.
Yeah.
But the point of the greatest story ever told so far is to explain the science. I think that's the point. The history is there to bring it alive and make it more accessible. But it's not, first and foremost, a history book. It's a book to explain the scientific concepts. I think that's the difference. The history for me, all my books have history in them because I find it fascinating, and I think it humanizes the story a lot. They're first and foremost popular science books. I guess that's the way to describe it.
You say that the real virtue of science is that it changes our perspective of our place in the cosmos, like art, music, and literature. And I don't know if I buy that.
Really? Why?
Well, art and music and literature involve the imagination, which of course science does, but there's a kind of a mystery, there's deep human emotions, there's transcending beauty. You would find that in science, but most people reading a science book wouldn't find that.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't agree. I think most people, when they look at a Hubble Space Telescope picture, find all of those features. It's a source of awe and wonder, transcendent beauty, and as I say, changing your perspective of yourself. It's true that the level of awe and beauty and wonder that you get depends upon the level at which you can appreciate things, but I think that's absolutely true for music and art as well. Whether you can appreciate Bach cantata, the level of your appreciation of that depends completely on the level of your musical expertise. And I know that there's whole level layers of music that I can't appreciate because I don't have that level of expertise. Similarly in art, I think the bar may be a little bit lower. And in literature, I also think, I mean, in level, you know, there are people who appreciate poetry at levels I'm sure I can't because they put more work into it. But I think fundamentally, science provides that if science didn't provide that feature for humans, then I'm not sure science would be worth doing. And science isn't worth doing just for the technology. It's worth doing because we as a human species gain a level of perspective of ourselves that drives us to keep doing it. It's that exploration. It's the satisfaction of understanding. It's a surprise, and I do think it's awe and wonder. But you're right that the level of awe and wonder depends upon how much expertise you have, and so I may have more awe and wonder when I see the equations of the Standard Model of Particle Physics than the average person. But when I write a book that explains that the world we see is an illusion, that the actual world underneath is incredibly different, when people cut to a level that people can appreciate in my writing, I believe it produces that same kind of awe and wonder. Or it should, and hopefully will.
Yeah, I disagree. I think it's a question of the brilliance of the writing. That's what I look for, is brilliant, moving writing. That's the key.
So,
It so what's, doesn't matter what you're writing about.
Well, sure. So exactly. That's my point. If it's brilliant moving writing about science versus brilliant moving writing about fiction or history, it does. It has the same impact. It moves you in exactly the same way.
It's the writing, though, that's the most important thing, not the science.
Is it the words or what the words represent?
It's the beautiful way they're put together. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, the fundamental topic is, you know, why are we here? You know, but science doesn't necessarily talk about matters of the heart.
It doesn't. It not necessarily, unless you're doing the science of love or the science of human emotions
or surgery.
Or surgery. But it does affect the matters of the heart. It makes your heart flutter if it's done right.
It's the words, exactly, not the science.
Well, but it's the words. It's the ideas. Your heart flutter when you realize that you're, you know, maybe your heart flutters when you realize that you're made up of the total, you know, worth of the chemicals in your body is 96 cents, or that, you know, if you strung out all the capillaries and blood vessels in your body, that they would stretch to the sun and back. I mean, there's some things that
those are facts.
Go, wow,
those are facts.
Yeah, but they're facts. So is the fact of loving someone.
It's way better to get caught up in literature that talks about love than it is about an equation.
It depends on the equation and the description and what it means. I think better is obviously a subjective thing. But many different things can make your heart flutter.
Totally.
And I would argue that that seeing a photograph of a cute puppy is a wonderful thing. And I sometimes tweet them because I have a dog and a cat that I find adorable. But a Hubble Space Telescope picture of something sometimes brings, or forget the Hubble Space Telescope, a picture of the Earth rise from the moon.
Yeah. It's the rendering. It's the rendering. It's the artistic rendering of that, as opposed to the subject. That's all I'm saying.
No, I don't think so. If you had a beautiful picture of a random planet, that's one thing. But a picture of the Earth as seen from the Moon, recognizing that the Earth, forcing you to realize that the Earth is a fragile sphere in that blackness of space, with an atmosphere that seems pencil thin, and that all of our lives and all of our hopes and all of our dreams and all of the dreams of our children and anyone who's ever lived reside on this pale blue dot, is very powerful. And it's powerful because of the science, because of the facts surrounding that picture. If it was a random beautiful planet, the image might be just as beautiful, but it would not stir you in any way as much as it does knowing the scientific facts of what it represents.
Yeah, we're going to have to disagree on that, because it's, in my opinion, talking about the hope, writing beautifully about the hope and searchingly about the hopes and dreams, that's and painting it and this sort of thing, that's the art.
I would argue that's part of the problem, in fact. It's only if people realize the fragility of the world in which we live that they will appropriately act. And that fragility comes from an understanding of the science. No matter how beautifully you write, it's the science behind the writing that causes you to rethink how you should act as a human being. And if it's just beautiful prose, you'll never act consciously to or support programs that act to maintain the sustainability of our planet.
I don't care about acting. I care about beauty. I care about being moved.
Do you care about your children?
Of course. That's got nothing to do with art. That's got to do with reproduction and posterity.
Do you care about the quality of their life?
Of course I do.
Do you care about the quality of it? Of course you do. And understanding the quality of their life requires you to understand the situation in which they find themselves on a planet with resources that are finite, with air and water that they can breathe, and so ultimately, I think your movement, your hopes and dreams for yourself and your children are impacted by your understanding of your place on this planet. for example, if science told you the world was going to end in 10 days, your hopes and dreams for yourself and your children would be dramatically changed. Yeah. Whether I put it as a bland sentence or as a beautifully described sentence about the end of life on Earth, once you understood the ideas behind that, your whole picture of your life, your own being, would change. And it would be science that would do that.
I'm not debating any of that. That's all understood.
Well, no. I would say that, look, Darwin wrote beautifully, and maybe you've read Origin of the Species, but the content, the ideas behind Origin of the Species, the fact that you understand that there's no difference between you and an amoeba in an evolutionary sense, that you are evolutionarily related to other animals and you are just an animal, I think affects your perspective of yourself and your everyday activities in a way just as profound as reading, you know, Ulysses by James Joyce or Shakespeare.
I totally agree with that. I'm just saying that science is not art, and I think you were trying to suggest that it was.
I will use the argument from a friend of mine who's an artist, or at least an actor named Alan Alda, who was once describing science and art. And he said, science requires great creativity, whereas art requires great precision. Maybe, you know, and what he said, the reason he did that is to turn things on their head. Most people think art requires creativity and science requires precision.
Yep.
The answer is they both require both. I don't know how you define art.
I'm saying the end product is different. That's all.
Well, what's the end product of art? I'm not going to let you get away with this.
Okay, well, no, what it is, it's just aesthetic pleasure.
What's the end product of art?
It's aesthetic pleasure. It's just the pure pleasure of reading words or looking at paint on a canvas or listening to a sublime melody. That is different from understanding that everything we see is an illusion. It's just different.
Well, I would say that, for example, when you look at a Van Gogh painting and look at his Starry Night, you realize that that's an illusion, but it captures something in you that moves you.
It does.
Okay, and I would say understanding certain aspects of the origin and evolution of the universe captures something in you that moves you.
It does.
And it has no practical use. I'm very proud of the fact that most of my scientific research has no practical usefulness whatsoever.
Yeah.
So if it has no practical usefulness whatsoever, why bother doing it? Why should we bother doing it?
Look,
we do it because it moves us forward as human beings, as cultural thinking beings. So culture is just a part of the intellectual process that makes up humanity.
Yeah.
And the joy we get from our art is what maybe what separates us from some other animals, but I would argue it's the same thing with our science.
Yeah, I know that, Lawrence, and I'm taking you to task for that. Okay, so getting back to why write about science, you've said that the purpose of science is to make you uncomfortable. That way you grow and learn.
It's perfect. The purpose of art too, by the way.
Yes, but they're completely different though. Yes, in different ways, in my opinion. So do you agree with that? That one of the reasons you write is to make people feel uncomfortable?
Well, it's part of education. Science more generally is part of education. Part of expanding your horizon is to be uncomfortable at some point. I don't do it to make people uncomfortable, but part of the process of expanding your horizons about yourself is often involves a lack of comfort. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. In this world where everyone wants to be comfortable and never be uncomfortable is a world in which there's no progress.
Yeah, and so that's a pretty good incentive to write about science.
I want to share the progress, and I write about science because I think it's fascinating. If I didn't, and useful for people to know about, if I didn't, I wouldn't be writing. I mean, it's all solipsistic at some level. I'm writing for myself, and I think most writers are, and to pretend otherwise is again an illusion.
Yeah, they're writing because they haven't been able to find what they want to read, I guess. That's one of the reasons.
I think you write because you have to write. I don't know, otherwise, why would you do that? Why would you spend all that agony sometimes?
Yeah.
I think it's something you need to do. And you hope that it'll, I think many of us who write hope that it will impact on others. But I know writers who have said, well, if I couldn't publish, I'd still write because that's what I need to do.
I like the fact that in the greatest story ever told so far, you talk about the fact that the story changes and that scientists are willing to change their mind as opposed to religious writers who have all the answers. You basically just discover things that produce new questions.
Yes, that's true, and we change our mind. Those are all wonderful things. The fact that it seems to be never-ending, that every new discovery raises new questions, is a wonderful thing. It's great. It's what I would call a kind of cosmic job security. But it also means the universe continues to be fascinating. And the fact that we change our mind is again, an example of progress, which is the reason there hasn't really been any progress in religion since the myths were first invented.
Yeah, people that are religious, they go there for all the answers, I think, and comfort as opposed to discomfort.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, they have the answers before they even ask the questions, which is a perfect example of how not to try and understand the world.
I think the other thing that's interesting that you bring up is the fact that scientists are skeptical. Scientists look for evidence and facts, and that this is exactly what citizens should do in a democracy.
Absolutely. That's why, you know, I'm just writing a piece about that, but that's the point of the Origins Project Foundation that I run. Without that basis, which is really a scientific method, then democracy can't function well. Without basing policy on the real empirical world and testing those policies and testing those ideas, and without an informed public that's able to use the scientific process to assess the people they vote for, you end up, you know, getting Donald Trump.
That's a pretty good reason to write about science.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a good reason to write about science because I do think that is an ancillary benefit. That demonstrating the scientific process encourages people to use the scientific process, yes.
You say that we're hardwired to look for purpose and design, and it's up to us to determine meaning and purpose, which is very existential.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. We create our own meaning and purpose, and that meaning and purpose can be based on illusion or reality. But we can choose how to do that. Yeah.
So you don't write about purpose and design.
No, I mean there is no purpose. I write to give people a sense of what they can decide is purpose. But I try not to tell people what purpose is. As far as design. Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by design. I think, you know, there's symmetry in nature, and if you want to call that design, then I write about that.
No, I guess what I'm talking about is this sort of extraterrestrial intelligence that people...
No, since there's no evidence that that exists, why should I write about it?
What about the fact that people experience quite amazing, and I have, coincidences. So it's just a coincidence, but in a way, a coincidence is proof of something if you're looking for something.
Oh, that's right. If you're looking for something, that's the whole point. To realize that we all think what happens to us is special is a key aspect of science, and we have to grow out of that and realize that what we think may be, you know, preordained is often just an accident. And that doesn't diminish it. But it overcomes an illusion. Now, we all have that in real life. I mean, you know, scientists are people. And so we all have, again, I told you, we're hardwired to assume what happens to us is significant. And in our daily lives, you know, that governs how we act. But in the back of our minds, we should realize that, you know, that's not the case. That coincidences happen. And, you know, and that's just the way it is. And if we don't, then we live under the illusion that someone is looking after us. Many people live their entire lives under that illusion and somehow survive. It's not an illusion I want to live my life under, though.
Yeah, I'll give you just a quick example of a coincidence for me, okay? I was looking for not a reason, but I wanted to basically live my passion for books about 10 years ago. It was a choice between doing what I've been doing for the last 10 years, which is running around the world interviewing fascinating people about books and not making any money, or continuing to make money in a way that I found pleasant, but not that fulfilling and interesting. So I was musing about God and how, and I'm an agnostic, about how he or she communicates with us on a very still day. And right when I was musing about it, a little breeze hit me in the face on a very still day. And I said, oh, it's through the wind. So I subsequently went for a little walk around the block. I saw a couple of people carrying boxes of books up to the pavement, and they were going to have a little sale. So I offered to help them to bring the boxes up. I went down into the garage. It was sort of underground. On the top of the pile of boxes, there was one box with a book on the top. And the book was titled, How Does God Communicate With Us? I flipped it over. On the back of the cover, there were six or seven ways. The first one was through the wind.
It's a nice story, but it doesn't mean anything, but it's a nice story. It's a, you know, but and here's the point. Here's the point, though. It may have changed you, but you remembered it because it was coincidence. The point is that in that same day, there were 100 other experiences that were just as surprising that you didn't remember because they didn't strike you as memorable. If for example, you had gone down and the top book was How to Build a Better Car, you wouldn't be telling me this story, but it would have been just as surprising. So we those things that we remember, it's, you know, and I'll use the example I've often used from Feynman, where, you know, you have crazy dreams every night, thousands of them, but one day you'll dream that a friend breaks their arm and the next day they break their leg and somehow you think there's some significance, but you'll forget the 10,000 dreams that you had that were nonsense. And so you only remember that which seems significant to you, and that's a lovely story because that bit of coincidence seems significant, but it has no more significance than that.
I guess the point is it's up to me to decide now, was that some guiding force that was helping me, or was it just a funny little thing that happened?
It's up to you to decide that, but the important thing is the answer is irrelevant. I mean, the reality of it is whatever you believe, the reality is what the reality is. And so you could choose to believe it. But once again, we're going back to Philip K. Dick. So, yeah. And I think you have to recognize that. And there's some things I can never, you know, I can't argue that, you know, a rainbow, you know, on a day when you're depressed, wasn't set there by someone to make you feel better. If that makes you feel better, that's fine. But that doesn't mean it was.
No.
Maybe that's
because you can't prove it. But I, as I say, that's the difference.
I can't disprove it, which more importantly, I can't disprove it. Proving it, we never can prove things. It's disproving things. I can't disprove it to you. I mean, I can tell you that a million other people who were depressed saw the same rainbow, but that still won't convince you. With the profound solipsism, to use that word again, that religious people have, they won't care that many other, you know, when their house was saved by a tornado, you know, in a tornado, and all the houses around them were destroyed and other people killed, they'll think it's an act of God, even though all the other people who were killed and their families destroyed won't necessarily feel the same way. And so, yeah, I won't be able to ever convince that person that it wasn't a miracle. But, but that's only because of their personal self-interest.
Yeah, it's just a little bit strange because what we're getting into is mystery, I think. And I think, again, you know, one of the things that's most beautiful about Tolstoy is how he describes the mystery of love and death. Mm-hmm. And what science is doing is trying to demystify.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think so what science is doing is looking for deeper mysteries, is seeking out deeper mysteries, and that's what drives us. It's the mysteries that drive us.
Yeah.
The seeking is better than the finding, I think, for most of us. So, but you know, it's just a different kind of mystery. But once again, you seem to think that different, that being different at some level means they can't have any relationship. And I think, well, you know, there's
I didn't say that
no,
for a moment.
I mean, I think art and science both deal with mysteries, and you're right. We're trying to demystify some things, but you know, I can't help but think that literature does that too. Again, maybe Tolstoy. I would say Shakespeare more for me.
Yeah, I think art
gives you a new perspective on the mystery of love, but at the same time, it gives you a new insights into human beings, which in some sense demystify them.
I think the beautiful words revel in the mystery, whereas science just wants to get to an answer.
Ask most scientists what drives them, and I think you'll find it's a mystery.
Okay, Lawrence, just one final question. And it seems to me that writing science, you're trying to, in a big sense, you're trying to answer the question, why are we here?
How are we here is ultimately the question I'm trying to answer. And we say why, but why presumes purpose, for which there may be. What I'm trying to understand is how the universe works and how we got here, which itself is an amazing story. But to say why presumes that there's some reason that we're here, and I don't think there is. I mean, any more than saying there's a reason the heart is located where it is. It's not because someone put it there, but, you know, it has, you know, the heart pumps in a certain way, and it's really how. So I continue to argue that the all-important why questions are really how questions.
Okay.
And so I think, you know, and that may be depressing or maybe not, but that's the way it is in my opinion.
Well, thanks very much for sharing how you feel and operate when writing about science. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Sure, it's been a fun discussion. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have. And I hope if anyone listens to it that they enjoy it. Let me know if you post it at some point.
I'll do that. And Lawrence Krauss, is over to you.
A writer, which is one of the reasons you're talking to me, and a scientist, and the president of the Origins Project Foundation, which one of the things does is connect science and culture and show that they're connected and gets people excited about the world, and host of the podcast with Lawrence Krauss, where I interview and where I have discussions with scientists, artists, writers, and we talk about the world and in a way that hopefully changes the way people think about themselves.
Very good. Thanks again.
Okay, sure. My pleasure. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.